This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
I've stood in enough village halls over the last few years to work out that nobody really wants it in their village.
Yeah.
Nobody really wants it in their town. And as we go through that local plan process, it's impossible, in my view, to get a local plan that pleases everyone. Completely impossible. And that's very hard as someone who's elected and someone who relies on the public for their position to accept, because you know that whatever you do, you might just be signing your death warrant.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to Kent Politics Podcast. In the week Dover braces itself for border chaos, Dartford is about to cop another 12,000 homes, and Medway picks a fight with the government. I'm Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by my usual accomplices, Robert Boddy, who reports on Medway Council.
Hello.
And Dan Essen, who covers borough and district councils.
Hello.
We'll also be speaking to political editor Paul Francis about the week in Westminster, and Paul will be speaking to our special guest, the leader of Tunbridge and Walling Borough Council, Matt Boughton. First up is Robert. What's been happening down your way?
Regular listeners will remember a couple of weeks ago when Medway Council wrote to the Department for Transport about the state of the roads in the towns. They said the extra £400,000 of reallocated HS2 money was not enough and estimated there were 2,000 potholes in the road network and the cost of bringing it all up to scratch would be around £50 million. Well, last Thursday at the full council meeting, the council released the response that they'd received from the Department for Transport, which could be described as dismissive at best.
So what did the DFT have to say for themselves then?
Well, so the short version is, and one echoed in the meeting by the Medway Tory group, was, it's your responsibility, stop blaming central government for your failings. The longer version mocked the £50 million figure, saying it surely didn't cost £25,000 per pothole. Guy Opperman, MP, Minister for Roads and Local Transport, also said, and I quote, I'm also sorry to hear that the £12 million extra the government has committed to Medway is not welcome. I understand why you will feel under pressure to say that, given the Labour Party in Westminster has refused to commit to the funding. But repairing the roads of Medway is your job. You should live up to your promises you made in your election and deliver for your electorate. This sentiment, that Medway Labour were trying to shift the blame, was echoed locally by both Tory councillors at the meeting and Rochester and Strood's Tory MP Kelly Tolhurst, who said Medway Council are, quote, in charge but not in control.
Not the support Medway Council might have hoped for, I guess. What was their reaction?
Well, they fired back their own letter, and later the council also put out a press statement saying they were surprised at the minister's response and its tone. They said they had made clear in their original letter that the £50 million was for all road improvements, not exclusively potholes. And also, they've been getting on with repairing potholes, saying they've fixed a total of more than 16,000 in the last financial year. They say they still want a meeting with the minister to discuss this more seriously, as the problem is greater than just mending potholes, and the current funding is just not enough. Outside of the statements and letters, council leader Vince Mabel told me the minister's comments were ludicrous, and hopes that the minister will reflect on their original response and come back with something a bit more productive, and also that Medway will not back down until it gets what it deserves.
Thank you very much, Robert. Dan, what's been happening at borough and district council level?
So the other day I was up in Dartford with our fellow local democracy reporter Gabriel covering Dartford Borough Council's new local plan, which they adopted at the meeting this Monday.
Okay, what's the upshot of their local plan? How many houses and where?
So the plan is for 12,640 homes to be built across the borough between now and 2037, which amounts to about 790 per year. And, you know, they've been averaging for the past few years about 600, so it's a bit of an increase. Dartford's jurisdiction is about 53% greenbelt because of its proximity to London in the form of Bexley. And they seem to have managed this time round, at least, to avoid plans for housing on the greenbelt, but the plan does allocate site for traveller encampments on greenbelt land. Unsurprisingly, the bulk of the borough's planned housing development is in the Ebbsfleet Valley, where a new garden city has been in the works for the best part of 10 years. However, I spent some time looking into the history and figures around that, which seems to suggest progress there isn't quite as fast as was planned.
Didn't they have a timeline?
So, Sort of. Newtown was announced in 2014, and the government created the Ebbsfleet Development Corporation, and which was charged with acting as the planning authority and getting 15,000 homes in the Ebbsfleet Valley. If you look at some of the old coverage when it was established, the entire point of the Development Corporation was to basically build faster and act faster than the usual council planning system. Under Darfur's new local plan, the council says they expect there to be 8,200 homes at Ebbsfleet by 2037. The Development Corporation has a slightly higher estimate. They reckon it will be about 12,000 by 2037. Obviously, things change a lot on such a massive and complicated project like building a new town. But either way, those numbers don't quite align with the timetable the corporation set itself a while back. In 2016, the plan they released said that they wanted just under 11,000 homes there by 2026. But under their own estimates, they won't hit that until about the mid-2030s, best part of 20 years after the programme was greenlit. There may be all sorts of reasons why building there has been slower than intended, like the pandemic getting in the way for a couple of years. But with planning policy and house building increasingly hot topics, some say that the reasons Ebbsfleet delivery has been slower, more structural than specific. Dartford's Labour opposition leader, Jonathan Hawkes, who actually represents part of Ebbsfleet, outright told me that Ebbsfleet is an example of the UK not building houses or infrastructure nearly fast enough. The way he was speaking about it in the meeting suggested that if Labour win the next general election, he hopes there'll be a turbocharging of development in places like Ebbsfleet, but obviously that remains to be seen.
Thank you very much indeed, Dan.
So, Simon, what's been going on at County Hall this week?
Well, Kent County Council has been to the Port of Dover to see preparations being put in place ahead of the implementation of new biometric checks at the French border controls at Dover and Folkestone Channel ports. And a delegation from KCC, comprising of leader Roger Goff and cabinet member for transport Neil Baker, were shown how the port authorities will cope with massive delays anticipated to be caused by the new EU entry exit system, which is the EES.
What does the entry-exit system actually entail for getting to and from the EU?
Well, in short, it's biometric capture of facial imagery and fingerprints. So in future, in the order to enter the EU through France, as we do in Kent, we'll have to give our biometric details. And this will be very, very time-consuming, as they have to be done sort of in person at the French border controls in Dover or Folkestone, or even up at St Pancras. This is thought to cause massive, massive delays, and the Port of Dover is coming up with ways to hopefully overcome the snarl-ups. There may be a processing centre away from the space-constricted area at the Port of Dover in the eastern docks, and Eurotunnel has been working at ways to also cut the delays.
I suppose the big question is, will it work?
Well, time will tell. Port of Dover staffers are being realistic enough to say that the response to the EES is well underway, but that there will be long delays despite whatever measures they bring in, and there will be inconvenience, and obviously forward planning is absolutely necessary in this case.
So is all this basically just because of Brexit?
Well, it is, effectively, because but many people have argued that those checks could be done in Calais, for instance, where there's a lot more space, and it would make more sense to have those border controls on the French side. Just for as it stands, this is how the EES works. The first stage is registration, where the traveller will have passports checked and they'll give their biometric data. And the second is to have those details validated across the border. There are planned increases by the Port of Dover for the number of booths, enhanced staffing levels, and a detailed modelling has been undertaken to determine the impact of forecasted flows of traffic through the port during that time. The French say that they need to cut down on the time it takes for manual passport stamping, and the French are allowed to have border controls on British soil because of a previous agreement.
So what's actually achieved by changing all these regulations for getting in and out of the continent?
Well, the EU wants to be able to keep track of potential overstayers, as the UK is now regarded as the third country. That wraps up what's been happening across Kent and Medway this week. Thanks to Robert and Dan for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next up is political editor Paul Francis with his Westminster Watch. What's been happening, Paul?
Well, it seems Westminster is in a frenzy of speculation about the date of the general election amid another flurry of resignations from MPs being caught out doing something they shouldn't have. They've got their own exit system.
Very good.
The frenzy comes about after the Prime Minister staked out very forcibly that he would get the Rwanda bill on the statute books, and its impact would be felt in 10 to 12 weeks. And if it was proving to be such a deterrent, then the argument goes, why not opt for an early election? That seems to be the thinking.
So how much do you think the local elections might impact on any decision to go early?
Well, that is definitely one of the issues that would be something he'd have to deal with and address, is that if they have, as everyone expects, a fairly disastrous set of election results, council election results, police commissioner results, then the troops on the ground are going to feel a bit disenchanted and a bit disaffected, and it's going to be something, take something to rally them back to fighting force for a general election. So there's internally within the party, things could be very difficult. So that's one reason why a summer election is not regarded as a favourite. And of course, you know, summer, there may be more benign weather, and we can expect to see the issue of small boats continues across the channel. I don't think the Rwanda bill is going to stop it completely. Then people will be on holiday, of course, and the last thing they want to do is be badgered by someone asking them who they're going to vote for. So my bet is that they are going to continue to look at some point in the autumn and possibly mid-November.
Or even as long as November, yeah, because I spoke to one Conservative MP, was that last week, and they were saying that they reckoned October is still the favourite time, but do you think you might push it a bit longer than that? What's the advantage in going in November? Because that's then pegged to the US presidential elections.
Yes, well, that's a reasonable point. It's not competing for attention, as it were, but it's will perhaps be overshadowed by the presidential affairs going on. And, you know, we have this problem, don't we, that we'll be in the run-up to Christmas as well, you know, in November. But I think Conservatives feel that they can orchestrate a timetable in which they use the party conference to be the launch pad for their general election campaign. And that's why this date in November is being seen as a possibility.
There are those who just think that it doesn't matter what they do, it's all going the same way.
Yeah, that's true. The one thing they haven't got on their side is time, and time is needed to kind of reverse their ailing fortunes and for some of these policies to show through, you know, things like inflation rates fallings are good news, but, you know, will people be feeling the benefit in their pockets at that particular time?
That seems to be a real issue, that despite the giveaways that have been happening, people getting pay rises, people getting sort of cuts in taxation, they don't seem to feel any better off.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to the time issue, the Tories have had 13 years in power, and just naturally the cycle moves on, the pendulum swings one way and then it swings another way.
Yeah. Okay, some constituencies again don't seem to have candidates, and including one where the popular Conservative MP Dim Tracy Crouch is standing down. What can you tell us on that one?
You have to remember that she made her announcement, I think, in late February, so there's a month or so passing, and they haven't yet managed to put the apparatus in place for a selection process. Now, I'm told by constituency officials that some point next week they will be advertising the vacancy. This is the Conservative Party, by the way, and inviting applicants on the approved list, as it's called, to apply if they want to. So the process, the ball is rolling, albeit slowly, in Chatham and Aylesford.
Wouldn't it be better for them to choose a local candidate, somebody with a bit of profile locally, rather than patch it somebody in from another part of the country?
Well, I think, speaking to officials, that they are trying to see if they can get local candidates to stand, because, as you say, knowledge of the constituents, the local figure, might go down better than someone who Conservative Central Office has imposed on them. So, yeah, speaking to officials, they were a bit worried, I think, that Conservative Central Office might use its powers to impose a list on them and to choose from that list. But we'll have to see how it goes. One candidate or potential candidate who is not going for the seat is Matt Borton, who we'll be hearing from later on in the podcast. Now, he's tipped as someone who might in time become an MP, but he told me that the time is not right, and he says he's got a job to finish at Tunbridge Morning, so there you go, he's not standing.
Listen, thank you very much indeed for your time, Paul.
It's a pleasure.
And I'll speak to you next week.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
At 31, he is one of the youngest council leaders in the country, but Matt Bottom hopes to steer Tunbridge and Mulling Borough Council through some choppy political and financial waters. Paul Francis caught up with Matt a couple of days ago.
I'm with Matt Borton, the leader of Tunbridge and Mulling Council. Thank you very much for agreeing to take part in our podcast.
That's okay. It's a pleasure to be talking to you, Paul, as always.
Yes. Well, let's start with how you got into politics, Matt. Well, was there a moment when you decided you wanted to get involved, and what was it? Or was it a gradual thing?
It was a gradual thing for me. I was one of those people who, I went to school in Maidstone. I was at Oakwood Park Grammar School and didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life at the end of it. I'd studied politics in sixth form, thought that was quite interesting. Went and got a degree in it. And while I was there, I did a bit of volunteering with the Conservative Party. Subsequently, did an internship in the local office in Paddock Wood. That saw me sort of working on the Rochester and Shrewd by-election in 2014. And it's kind of spiralled from there as doors have opened over time. And I've walked through them and ended up in the position I'm in today. So I wouldn't say there was ever a great plan.
Did your family come from a political background?
No,
are they politically active?
No political activity of any sorts, really. Floating voters, generally. Really, I'm the first person in my family who's taken an interest in it.
And did you have any particular politicians you admired at that time that really made you think that this was something you wanted to get into?
I mean, it's quite a hard question to answer that, because some people will say, yes, my political hero is sort of Margaret Thatcher or Tony Blair or any of the big figures on the right or left, but I wouldn't say that I've got a political hero as such. As I said, I'm not from a politically engaged family, and it wasn't something we discussed over the dinner table growing up at all. It was more sort of like your daily problems in life. So everyone sort of says to me, who's your political hero? And the truthful answer is I don't really have one. I mean, there's people I admire for sure, but there's no one who I sort of set out to say, I want to be like them.
Yeah. So who was the Prime Minister at the time you kind of got your internship?
2014, when I finished university.
Oh, right.
And, did an internship with the Conservative Party leading up to the 2015 election, based locally. So got to know, obviously, the local activists very well and continue to be in touch with them today, even the ones outside of Tunbridge and Morlin. And that's really where it started locally for me.
It was John Stanley the MP?
Yeah, John Stanley had just come to the end of his term, or was coming to the end of his term. Tom Tugendhat had just been selected for the seat at the time. We also had Helen Whateley coming in.
Yeah. Lots of new faces.
There was lots and lots of new faces around, including me, I suppose.
Yeah, there might be some more new faces. After. Yeah.
You never know, but I think there'll be new faces regardless of who they are.
I mean, you're now one of the youngest leaders of, I think, any council in the UK, actually. I'm not sure if you've done the research on that. But
It was quite funny, because when I became leader 2021, so 3 years ago now, someone from the District Councils Network got in touch with me, and they said, we think you're the youngest leader of the council in the country. And I thought, well, I mean, that's nice. That age is just a number, I think. It didn't really sort of bother me. And then they got back in touch, and they said, oh, there's a leader of a council down in the West Country who is 4 days younger than you. And at that point, I started to think, oh, it's a bit of a shame, really. But, I mean, had it been sort of like a year, I wouldn't have minded. But four days, I thought, nearly the youngest.
I mean, it's not... some people would not regard local government as a kind of the sexy bit of politics at all, would they? I mean, how would you counter that? What were you saying to you?
Local government is a bit of politics that I think is where you can make the biggest difference. And what motivates me every morning, and when I sort of come to the office here within the council offices of Tunbridge and Mulling Council, it's just sort of driving through the towns and villages thinking, actually, we can make a difference to these places, a positive difference. We can make it better. We can make the high streets more vibrant. We can encourage more business into the area. We can make it tidier. And that's the sort of thing that makes me get out of bed in the morning and think there's things to go and things to do. And I feel you can get much more of that locally than perhaps national politicians can. Yeah,
because you can take the decisions, can't you, as in the government, which maybe you'd not be able to do in Parliament.
Exactly. And obviously, it's very important to sort of have that local government representation and obviously your MPs as well. But sometimes you just find your niche, and perhaps my niche is local government. That's not to say that I haven't got any respect at all for MPs. Far from it. They've got a really tough job, and I get on very well with all of the MPs in our immediate area. But I enjoy being a councillor. I enjoy helping people. I enjoy being able to go up to and deal with an individual problem and make life better for that person. That's satisfying.
So you're much more on the front line than perhaps you would be in.
There's nowhere to hide. There's nowhere. You can't say, oh, sorry, I'm in Parliament today. I can't come to your particular event. You are here and you're accessible all the time. In some ways, you feel a bit guilty whenever you leave the borough, regardless of what you're doing, because you always think you've got to be there and present and available to help people.
Yeah. Now, we know local government's going through enormous challenges at the moment, a lot of them to do with money, a lot of the council saying they're on the brink of or going bankrupt. I'm presuming you're going to tell me things fine and hunky-dory in Tunbridge and Morley, which on the surface does look to be the case. Or
financially, we're really in quite a good position when you compare us to other local councils. We're one of only a few councils in the country now that doesn't have any debt. And obviously, we see from Kent County Council the problems that they've had with debt repayments over the years. So, of course, we start from a good place. But there's a fundamental problem that local government has had over recent years, which is as its costs have increased, they've increased at the same rate that costs in the private sector do. And generally, that's around the rate of inflation. But of course, unlike probably any other business or any other organisation or any other part of the public sector, really, you're limited in what your income can be because obviously you've got a cap on how much you can raise council tax by. And not necessarily this year, because obviously inflation has come down quite quickly, but certainly last year and the year before, we found a situation where our costs were increasing above and beyond what our income was increasing by. And therefore, you have to make savings. And that's some really challenging decisions because actually, councils, I think, have done a very good job. And Tunbridge and Morley, my predecessor, Nick Heslop, was excellent at this in terms of understanding the limits in terms of what you're able to afford and really focus in on certain key issues. But sometimes you have to think outside the box. And we've had to do a bit of that recently. And that's obviously been challenging as well, challenging for councillors and challenging for myself as leader in being able to say to the public, we're doing this to help make life better for you. But at the same time, sometimes that might mean paying a bit more for
certain services. You talk about, I'm going to come on to that, so you preempted my question. We know savings have had to be made. At the same time, people are saying, well, I'm paying much more for my wheelie bin or my brown garden compost bin, for example, and parking and so forth. I mean, aren't you guilty of self-taxing on top of the council tax?
I mean, the reality is that as all of the costs of these services have increased, the cost of our waste contract has increased, the cost of the parking service has increased, we pay business rates on car parks, so obviously they've increased CCTV costs as well. You're not able to use your council tax revenue to fund those services like you did in the past, so you have to look towards fees and charges. And the fairest way is to get people who are using the service to pay for it, otherwise you have to, in essence, look somewhere else to pay for a service that's not necessarily related. And the concept of the user paying, I think, is quite important if you want to use a service, because ultimately nothing the council provides is free of charge. We are paying for this through our council tax. And obviously, as a Conservative, I take quite a strong view on this as well, which is we need to encourage and facilitate the private sector where possible, and the public sector needs to be able to provide those services. This absolutely must. The challenge, I think, for local government is kind of working out what residents expect it to provide as well, and given the financial envelope, that's becoming increasingly difficult to deliver.
I mean, the logical extension from that is, so if you say it's the user has to pay, you're not the county council, so maybe you'll reject what I'm about to say, but if you applied that to county councils, you'd have people saying, well, I've got no kids at school, so why am I paying the council tax?
Exactly, and that's where it gets challenging, that particular argument. Now, ultimately, you've got to recognise what benefits society as a whole, and take something like waste collection, for example. Everyone has waste. Doesn't matter who you are, you will put stuff in the bin and the bins need to be collected. So that's a universal service that you provide to everyone. But not everyone has a garden. So why should people in flats fund the cost of collecting garden waste from people who have gardens? And that's where I think...
I go to bed thinking about this.
Yeah, I do. And that's part of the joys of being a councillor, I suppose. And it's thinking about that sort of moral question. Yeah. Because, of course...
But you see, you understand the point.
Completely. Oh, completely. Yeah. And there's no right or wrong answer to it. And it comes down to looking at the budget holistically and looking where your priorities are. We'd like to rebuild a leisure centre in Tunbridge. Well, fantastic. But that's requiring a lot of financial investment that we're going to have to put in over a period of time. So that's an ambition that we've got. To fund that, we're going to need to save up, frankly, and we're going to look at see if whether we can generate a financial surplus from other services to be able to pay for that. So it's a really tricky balance, and as I say, there's no right or wrong way to do it, but your job as a councillor, and particularly a leader of a council, is to provide that leadership, I think, and to be able to say, look, residents are telling us that we want to do this particular thing. They tell us this particular service is important. How can we best facilitate that as far as we possibly can?
Obviously a very challenging environment. I mean, is there much pleasure in the job at the moment? I mean, surely your biggest challenge is persuading the government to give you some more money, isn't it, I would have thought?
I mean, I always like to go, and when I speak to leaders of other councils, I always say to them, and I'm not joking, that I've got the hardest job of the lot. A few of them sort of look around, they say, well, we're all in this together, and we are all in this together. It doesn't matter what your party, but of course I'm running the council on the mayor's casting vote, and obviously there is my own group and two independents who we're in partnership with, and you can't get much tighter than that. So to be able to deliver any sort of change is really challenging, and you need to have a consensus of opinion behind you. And obviously, I used to lead the council when it was in majority, and obviously you're just talking to your particular group in that case, and you know you've got the numbers. But now it's about getting cross-party support for everything. And that just is more time-consuming. That takes up a little bit more bandwidth as well, and requires compromises on all sides. So that in itself is probably my biggest challenge, because you can give us all of the money that you want to the government. I still got the problem of being able to get councillors to agree on what to spend it on.
How would you assess your general financial position? I mean, is it...
It's good, I think. I'd say we're in a good place for local government, for sure. A
lot compared to some of the councils.
Exactly. I mean, we only need to look over the water at Thurrock or over the boundary in Surrey, that you see in some councils that have gone or are going bankrupt quite quickly. We're not near that territory yet, but we look at our financial projections over the next 10 years, and although it's balanced at the moment, we know that we've got to find just under £2 million worth of savings, and that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And that's going to require some hard decisions, and we know we've got some potential cliff edges with contracts that are expiring that are likely to cost much more than they are at the moment. So obviously if we do nothing, that will just increase, and we will end up in that position, because ultimately you've got to make ends meet, and you can only spend what you get in.
Yeah. So you know, some people might say, well, there's a good way of saving money, and that's to merge councils or have them work as a single entity. And this is about devolution and unitary arguments. Is there a case for that that you would subscribe to?
I mean, it's
could you preserve your individuality?
It's really confusing for any ordinary person to know which council does what when you're in a two-tier system or three-tier system with parish councils as well. And can I give you a good answer as to why you've got the Highways Department at Kent and the Planning Department at Tunbridge and Morlin? I can't. I mean, this is a situation that has been around since the 1970s. I think there's a direction of travel that's happening across the country at the moment, which is that councils are turning generally from districts into unitaries. Some are bigger, some are smaller, and some of that has come along voluntary, some of that has been forced upon by financial situation of councils. So I don't think you can ignore that as well. My fear is about whether your local council relates to the communities within it. So of course the challenge that we've got in Tunbridge and Morlin is it's not one community, it's a collection of communities. And I know that if we're doing something that's really good in Tunbridge, and that Tunbridge is really quite solidly behind, a lot of the councillors and the communities at the Morlin end say, well, what's about us? Yeah. And vice versa. And in some senses, you can't win, and that sometimes does produce the lowest common denominator. Mm. It requires a loss of skill and understanding of the different places. So I think the biggest challenge for me, if we were to end up going down the unitary route, is the size, to make sure that it's small enough to care about each individual community. And I think Tunbridge and Morlin does that well. But it's also big enough to matter, because we want to have a voice. We want to be able to leverage in private sector investment. We want the government to respond to our concerns. We want to be able to be that driver of economic growth that's actually in a constrained community like ours. And we're constrained, obviously, by everything that people see every day around our infrastructure. we can still get the growth that will help make people richer and get that wealth into our communities as well. So I think that's the challenge. I think the size is where it all starts, rather than the structure.
We're often told that discussions and talks and debates started internally within parties. Is that the case for you?
I mean, it's not something that's proactively mentioned, but obviously you can't not take notice of what's happening elsewhere. And I've been quite open with other councils as well, which is if we want to have a chat and sit round a table and get our crystal ball out and plan what might happen in the next few years, then I'm absolutely up for that chat. But we'll obviously have to work out why we're doing it and when we're doing it, if that's the route that we go down. Because it won't be my decision. It won't be that, even if Tunbridge and Morley Council came out and all 44 councillors said, we would like to go to unitary status, we won't be able to do it on our size. We'd have to do it with neighbours as well. And obviously there's the impact on Kent as well, and there's lots of different sort of consequences arising from it. So it's not something I get terribly excited by, but I do think it's something that you need to be alert to as a potential future risk in terms of actually how services are delivered to residents, because that's what this is all about.
It's also about the devolution and what shape that would mean for Kent, and there's talk of a directly elected mayor and so forth. Is that just another tier of bureaucracy you could do without? So if you have a kind of devolved entity, whatever it might be, doesn't it need a figurehead?
I think there's definitely an argument to say that a devolved entity needs a figurehead, and a lot of the mayors have been quite successful in terms of putting themselves on the map, regardless of which party they're from. So I'm not, and I know that this view isn't necessarily shared by Kent County Council, I'm not against the concept of a mayor of Kent personally. I think the challenge is going to be, what do we get? What does that replace? Because as you say, Paul, if that's in addition to the current structure, then you're right, that's another layer of bureaucracy. We've got Police and Crime Commission elections. And in my view, Matthew Scott has been an excellent Police and Crime Commissioner for Kent. He's really helped us in Tunbridge and Morley. We've got lowest crime in the county, so I like to think we're a good example as to how to work successfully. But is that something where having a figurehead has helped in terms of public confidence in the police? I'd argue yes, but I'd also argue that that's very much the case under Matthew. I wouldn't necessarily say his predecessor, Anne Barnes, demonstrated that well.
Yeah.
So it is a risk. It can go both ways, and sometimes it depends on who is elected into those directly elected positions. One thing I think is quite clear for me, though, is that it must replace something. It can't be in addition to the current structure, because then we just make life even more confusing for residents, which is the last thing that any of us wants to.
Moving on to some of the kind of political issues, if you like, the big one is always housing development. I was reading through some articles and saying, is there anything else going on apart from housing development? How do you square the circle of needing more affordable homes with protecting the countryside and the Garden of England, as it were?
I don't really want to sort of make people feel sorry for myself in this, but councils are in an incredibly tricky position. And I know a lot of really good councillors who've lost their seats over housing developments that they've either opposed or tried to oppose or been overturned or overruled. And that's really hard for them as well. Look, we've got two responsibilities in this field as a borough council. And I could walk down a corridor and go to a housing department who would tell me one thing. And I could walk down a corridor and go to our planning department and who'd tell me something completely different. And on one hand, we've got this huge waiting list of people who need housing, who are in unsuitable or overcrowded accommodation. They've been accepted as being homeless and they've got a local connection. And obviously, these aren't people who necessarily on the street, so it's not people we can see, but behind the front door of houses, there's some stuff that's really quite sad to see. And we absolutely need to provide housing for them. But then on the other side, you've got a borough that's 71% greenbelt, that's just under 40% natural landscape, used to be area of outstanding natural beauty. And the challenge that we've got there is actually getting suitable sites to deliver the homes that we need. And even when you take out those two factors and you say, right, we're not going to touch Greenbelt, we're not going to touch the area of outstanding natural beauty, as it was called, you get sites that come forward and sometimes come forward from developers without the council's consent, and they want to seek planning permission. So just the other day, I was at a public meeting in Ditton, and 1,300 homes, the East Moreland Trust want to build. It's not an allocated site in local plan, and it's a site in which I told the East Moreland Trust we would welcome them bringing forward. And, of course, residents there are frankly outraged by the proposal. I completely understand why. And they ask me, how am I going to fight the development? And of course, you can't really give a simple answer to that, because you can't fight everything. And you legally have to go through the planning permission process. So you've got to find a good reason to turn it down if you want to turn it down. You can't just turn it down tomorrow because we don't like it. And that's a very tricky message to portray. And I've stood in enough village halls over the last few years to work out that nobody really wants it in their village.
Yeah.
Nobody really wants it in their town. And as we go through that local plan process, it's impossible, in my view, to get a local plan that pleases everyone. Completely impossible. And that's very hard as someone who's elected and someone who relies on the public for their position to accept, because you know that whatever you do, you might just be signing your death warrant. It's very hard to comprehend at times.
Is there a way of improving the planning system which might level the playing field? I mean, developers are allowed to appeal rejections, but not maybe groups of residents that right of appeal isn't afforded to residents groups, for example.
And I agree that that seems a little bit backwards, and surely the right of appeal should apply both ways. Mm. But I don't think that alone would solve the problem. Personally, I think there needs to be many more incentives that are available for brownfield land to come forward first and to come forward quickly. Obviously, we've had the brownfield land release fund that the government have done. That's great, but I think it needs to be accelerated. I think there needs to be more money put towards that. The challenge...
Does that benefit Tunbridge Wealden because of the nature of the area in terms of the availability of...
Well, it doesn't benefit us as much as it would others, because, of course, being a rural borough, our biggest town is Tunbridge, which isn't as big as places like Tunbridge Wealden and Maidstone. But, of course, because we're rural, we have fewer of these big sites to utilise. But if it was a bigger funding pot, we might be able to utilise it for some smaller brownfield sites as well. I think it all starts, if I'm honest, from the housing numbers, which in our case are just under 16,000 by 2040. And are they unrealistic? I think they are, given the infrastructure constraints. I would really like a lot of the organisations who are responsible for providing advice and comments on planning applications to be a bit more robust. I'd like Kent County Council Highways to start saying, actually, you know, Hermitage Lane is crowded as this is.
Yeah.
And the impact is severe. I'd like them to do that a bit more. I'd like the NHS to be a little bit more robust around GPs, for example. But the thing that would help councils the most comes down to that housing target as well. And given that the council doesn't actually build any houses, all we do is allocate sites, you need some sort of credit for allocating sites. If then the builders don't build it for economic reasons, or they've got an alternative project that they want to work on first, the council gets penalised for that, because something called a five-year housing land supply recognise land that's built, not land that's given permission. So that's a really simple and easy change that I'd like to see that would help. So there's a lot of smaller changes that can be made that I think would have quite a big impact in our favour.
Put your Conservative hat on for a moment, rather than talking about the council. Have you got the enough time to turn around the party's fortunes before an election, or are you reconciled to being...
Look, you can't pretend that the polls aren't telling the truth, and the polls are indicating that you'll have a Labour government, whether that's as a majority or as a minority or in coalition with someone else. And I think you get to 14 years for us, it's 13 years for Labour beforehand. Margaret Thatcher and John Major have done 18 years, and the country just ready for a bit of a change. And I accept that.
You can't change time.
I can't. Have the Conservative Party helped make it itself so unpopular? I think elements of it have. And I have to say, I think some MPs have behaved appallingly over the last few years, because they've just drawn attention towards issues that either, frankly, don't need to be raised, or they're around conduct, or they aren't focusing on what people want to see. It goes back to what I was saying earlier about why do I enjoy being a councillor, because you can sort of... You are close to the community. You can make a difference. You can walk down the street and say, I did this. Or you can walk down the street and say, actually, that needs moving. You can actually do something about it. I think actually part of the problem is that Parliament has got itself so wrapped up in certain issues that it's taken away from what people want to see, and it's created a bit of disconnect.
A large bit. I mean, we've also seen the kind of increase in popularity of some of these smaller minority groups like the Reform Party, populist rather than popular necessarily. But does it worry you? Is that going to shave off some support from your voters?
It's quite funny, really, because take just locally, we lost a lot of seats to the Green Party last year. Mm-hmm. You think, well, the Conservatives and the Greens got quite common, and I can tell you here at Tunbridge and Morley, not very much. But of course, voters were saying to us, oh, we might vote Green rather than Conservative. And I was sort of having this debate with a few of them, which actually you realise you're basically the polar opposite here. But of course, I think the idea of sort of traditional left-right spectrum is diminishing quite quickly because people haven't got the party loyalty that they once had. And it means that actually you can do a particularly bad job and you've lost a really sort of large part of your support straight away. And I think we've seen a bit of that with Reform in the last year as well. Reform have taken quite a significant number of voters from Conservatives, should the polls to be believed. So I think the root cause of that is a policy on it. It says to me straight away that the government needs to quickly source out the issues around small boats and migration and needs to do whatever it can before a general election in order to stop that tide.
Mm.
Just like when you look at the rise of the Greens, the government needs to look at the environmental agenda and think, is it doing enough? Because there's certainly a generation of voters coming through, a generation, my generation really, who are very concerned about the environment.
Yeah.
So actually, these are responses to particular issues that people care about, and the Conservative Party just needs to work out how best it can adapt to the wishes of people.
So the big question is, Tom Tugendhat going to run again, do you think?
It's a shame you didn't get it. I mean, look, as you know, Paul, I know Tom very well. Yeah. I've known him for 10 years. We get on extremely well, and he's done a lot for me, and I like to think I've done a lot for him as well. Would we have ended up in this position with Tom as leader? I would say no, wouldn't I?
Mm.
But Tom's first challenge is going to have to be to get back in Parliament.
Yeah.
And obviously his seat has had some significant boundary changes as well. He does work hard as a local MP, and I'll be out there campaigning for him, just like I'm doing for Helen Grant and whoever will replace Tracy Crouch in the Chatham Aylesford seat as well. So
I mean, look at the size of the majorities though, Matt, and you know, they're pretty big for most of your MPs, aren't they? Are you saying that's because 2019 was the Brexit election that they were, and that artificially inflated?
You see, I think because there's so much fluidity, as I said earlier, about voters, that you can't really rely on what you got in 2019 as a barometer. Mm. Boundary changes will impact that as well.
Yeah.
They will make particular seats more or less vulnerable. And obviously MPs build up a bit of the personal profile in their areas. Well, if they've got new areas coming in, they don't have that personal profile as well. I think that's a real challenge and probably doesn't help any of our MPs re-standing for election.
I mean, because you look at the numbers and they're growing at... It's called an exodus of MPs. And actually, that may be because a lot of them are seeing the writing on the wall.
You can say that. And obviously, each MP who stands down has got their own personal reasons for doing so. Take someone like Gordon Henderson, for example. He basically said he's got to the age in which he'd like to retire.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I mean, everyone sort of gets to that age at some point, don't they? And so I don't think that was necessarily linked to the state of the of the polls. Ultimately, though, it's hard work to be elected. It's hard work getting elected. And then once you are elected, you want to have the influence to deliver the policies that you've stood for election on. No one ever pays you to be a candidate at all. And
you have to pay to be a candidate.
In our case, you don't. But it's evenings, it's weekends, it's time away from your family. And anyone who puts themselves forward for election, and particularly obviously to be an MP, because you take a huge risk that you'll all of a sudden one day be a cabinet minister, perhaps even the prime minister, and then you'll sort of boost out of your job at 4 o'clock in the morning in a leisure centre in the depths of winter. Yeah. I mean, it's brutal.
It is, yeah.
Absolutely brutal. And ultimately, when you stand for election, you have an idea about whether you're going to be successful or not. And take last year when we had the council elections, I completely prepared myself that I wouldn't be leaving the council again. I knew where we were in the polls at the time, and I thought, well, this has been an enjoyable couple of years. I've enjoyed being a councillor. I'd like to stand again.
Yeah.
If I win my seat, great. If I end up being leader of the council afterwards, that's a bonus. And you kind of just, you think, what next? Because you enter that room, that cow pool, and you haven't got a clue what the future holds. No clue whatsoever.
Yeah.
And that's hard. I'm not going to lie. That is very hard.
I mean, do you have any personal ambitions about parliamentary bid?
Not right now. I mean, it's quite funny because my phone was red hot once the news about Tracy standing down came out, given obviously the seat is in the borough. But my wife and I have got a baby on the way in August.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Paul. I'm having a few sleepless nights at the moment, yeah. But I think I'll be having a few more after that.
Yes.
But obviously we've got, so personally, the timing doesn't work for me. I've got a job to do here at Tunbridge and Morley Council. I want to do it. I feel I've got unfinished business. I always have sort of joked to my friends and said, if one day I ever try and do that, it means I've had a midlife crisis that stopped me. But at the moment, it's not the right time. But I don't want to turn around now and say no, never in the future, because I might have that midlife crisis and stand for Parliament. At the same time, I don't want to sort of say, yes, I desperately want to be an MP, because I don't. I simply want to do the best for the community, and I'm simply, I like public service, and that's what motivates me to get up in the morning and come into work and do my best for the communities. And if public service means being an MP in the future, great. If it doesn't mean being an MP, I'm not going to sort of regret that in the slightest. It's a privilege to do the job that I do. It's a great honour. It's got some great upsides and it's got some significant downsides as well. You've got to enjoy the moment, because the moment's not going to last forever.
Yeah. So you're leaving the door ajar.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you want to paint it like that, Paul, you're welcome to paint it like that, because as I said, I don't think it'll ever be no, and I don't think it'll ever be yes, definitely. Yeah. And just sort of see what happens.
Yeah.
My whole career has been based on sort of doors have opened, and I'm the sort of person that sort of peeks in and then goes through it if it's interesting.
Well, it's interesting.
Open, that's fine.
People are candid about their ambitions or their position, often regarded by voters as more honest in some senses, because they're not hiding their ambition. It's very English things, and for people to say, oh no, I don't entertain that idea at all. You know, then.
Well, do you remember when Boris said about the ball coming out the back of the scrum and he picked it up if it was there?
Yeah.
And in some ways I sort of admired that about him, because I think with something like that, you've got to have a degree of honesty about whether you'd think about the job. When I became leader of the council, I never expected to do it. The previous leader resigned quite quickly, and circumstances sort of meant that a lot of the group wanted me to do it, and I thought about it for a night and I had chat with my wife and my family and thought, yeah, let's go for it, and I'm glad I did. But I'm sure if the opportunity ever presented itself in the future, I'd have that conversation. And if I say no, I'd probably be comfortable with that decision as much as it was when I said yes. Of course, when my phone was red hot on the day Tracy announced she was standing down, I said to my wife Amanda, I said, a lot of people want me to do it. And we just sort of looked at each other and it was, this isn't the right time.
Yeah.
Right time for us personally, the right time for us politically. So I'm not going to pretend that I wouldn't think about it in the future. But at the same time, I'm not going to sort of sit here and say it's a burning desire.
Yeah, you sound a bit like Ken Clark, who, whenever he was asked, said, yes, of course I'd like to be the leader, at some point. And he never hid his kind of aspiration or ambition on that.
Exactly. But at the same time, can you fulfil what you want to in public life without being an MP or without holding a position of leadership? You absolutely can, because you owe your position. I owe my position to 1,201 people who put their, or sorry, 1,200 people plus myself, I did vote for myself, put their cross next to me in the elections last year. And then I owe my position to 22 or 21 other colleagues who voted for me to be leader of a council. And you mustn't forget that loyalty and all the people who elected those other
people. You remember the people on the way up as well as on the way down.
Exactly. And it's about people having their say. And we have one vote per person in the country. It doesn't matter how rich or poor you are. Doesn't matter whether you're left-handed or right-handed, whether you live in the north or the south, whether you drive a car or don't drive a car. It doesn't matter. You've still got one vote, and democracy will win at the end of the day. And as I said, at some point in the future, this will all come to an end, and that's absolutely fine. And I'll go off and do something else. But I just want to make the most of the time that I've got in the role, and if that leads to something else, well, it leads to something else. If it doesn't lead to something else, then at least I can turn around and say I've been able to influence the community that I live in, and then that's fine for me.
Well, that's a very good point on which to end, Matthew. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us.
That's right. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thanks to everyone for joining me on this week's podcast. We'll be back next week when we'll be having a chat with one of the county's most recognisable and outspoken political figures, Mike Baldock. You can follow us now on X, formerly Twitter. Just search for Kent Politics Podcast. And don't forget to tune in to KMTV at 5 p.m. each Friday for their politics show. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.